guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and this time we're going to run the tech net. We're about to find out, is there anybody out there in radio land that's not watching the Academy Awards tonight? Might be. Soon find out. This is a gathering of the clan of curious radio amateurs. I want to find out more about how radio works. They meet on Sunday night, starting at 8 o'clock, usually until midnight, discussing their favorite subject, transmitters, receivers, antennas, transmission lines, propagation. Yeah. 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio. The usual schedule, which you have derived over the years, is that for the first hour or so, we take general questions, try to give somewhat brief answers, and those check-ins are only people who have a real question or comment for the net. You need not check in because you're listening. This is TechNet number 1544. After 32 years, we believe somebody's listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. After that first hour, John, KC2WGB, opens his mailbag.
KC2WGB.
All right, Dick.
Okay. Was that you, John?
Yes, I'm having some issues here with Echolink. Sorry about that.
Not to worry. So John opens the mailbag where people have sent him messages because they don't yet have their ham license or they don't yet have the equipment to talk to us directly over the air. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, a space expert, who tonight will be giving us a space report number 137 of the series, in which he keeps us up to date on what National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing. And I keep asking him, how's Voyager doing? My favorite spacecraft. Out there, 120 some odd astronomical units, billions and billions of miles away, still transmitting to us since 1977. What is that, 37 years, at the little 20-watt QRP transmitter. Transmits all those billions of miles. And it's still alive and kicking. Along the way, we have Hal K60PZ, who has a lot of radio experience, who sometimes gives us the brief answer. Although a week or two ago, we switched roles. He gave the more complete answer, and I gave the more brief answer. A person signs into the TechNet. Let me drop. By giving those four guys your call letters, your name, followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A possible sign-in might be KC2WGB, John, and yes. So give me a call letters and name right now, K2RIW.
Here we go, Rich and yes.
We got Rich, anyone else? Net, let me drop. I did it for guys. So as you can tell, we're going to be having some repetitive information here tonight. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters right now and name.
Antrixian.
Wes recognized. So we got Rich and Wes. Anyone else?
WS2N, Paul, space report. Good evening, John, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. And Paul, will that be space report number 137 of the series? Anyone else to check in because you do have a question? Okay, I heard him on the input saying yes, it is number 137. Okay, so we've got Rich, Wes, Paul. Anyone else to check in with a question or comment for the net tonight? Give me your call letters and name right now. Looks like almost everybody's watching the Academy Awards. Wonder if the ham radio should have an Academy Awards celebration. So, Rich, what question would you like to ask tonight? N2EO, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, N2EO. First of all, how am I getting in? Because Plainview from...
I'm hearing you beautifully on the input, so whatever doesn't come through the machine, I'll repeat. Not to worry. Go ahead, Rich.
more of a request than a question.
I'm hearing you beautifully on the input, so please proceed, Rich. N2EO, K2RAW, the TechNet.
I would like to get a group of YMARC members here. 25 ask.
Very fine, Rich. Not all of what Rich said came through the machine, but I was copying him 100% on the input. Rich N2EO is about to buy a Kenwood TS-2000, which covers 160 meters through 440. And as soon as the weather gets a little bit warmer, about April or May, he would like to put up his Cushcraft R8 antenna. He'd also like to put up an NFED ZEP antenna. Because he has a leg amputated and he's wheelchair bound, he's not able to do the normal antenna work, so he's looking for a volunteer for April or May. Might require a 25-foot ladder to put up those antennas for Rich so that he can have his radio connection with his friends. So, and Rich does want us, let me drop. He wants us to repeat this message a few times between now and April so he can line up an antenna-raising party. And some good food is promised, and good fellowship, but he doesn't have the 20 or 25-foot ladder. That'll have to be supplied. He's got the R8, and the NFED ZEP is pretty easy to assemble, even if he doesn't have that already. But he'll be looking for a volunteer. Anything else that I should add to that, Rich? N2EO, K2RAW, the TechNet.
Right, you... A few times in March, it would be much... And like I said, Airfly barbecue. I'll try... Patricia, if she would make sure...
So what Rich was saying is that barbecue feud... Food is being promised by Patricia and him, and so March, April, May, in that time frame, since we get better weather, and we'll be repeating that for Rich in the future. Okay, let's take any other late check-ins to the TechNet. Is there anybody out there who's got a real question or a comment for a ham radio-like substance? Is there anyone else out there that's not watching the Academy Awards? Give me a call. That is right now. K2LAW.
K2RW, KC2UJL, listening on the net, KC2, United Juliet Lima.
Okay, we got you, Mr. UJL. Anyone else?
KC2, MDP, Steve, and yes.
Maybe.
Okay, we got you, Steve, KC2, MDP. And I think I hear another station in there that was doubling with you, Steve. Anyone else check into the TechNet? Give me a call that is a name right now.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Mike, Papa, Joe, yes.
Very fine, we got you to Bravo Mike, Papa. And out of curiosity, Joe, you have a question for the net, or you would like to make an announcement. If it's an announcement, we'll schedule you right now. W2BMP, Senior President, K2RAW. Go ahead, Joe.
Just a regular question.
Okay. And I'm not sure, but I thought I heard another station that didn't make it. Give me your call that is right and name right now if you're trying to check in, because you do have a question or a comment.
I think I have a little bit dead in them. I'd like to give out my phone.
Okay, we heard that so far, Rich. Hang in there. Was there another person trying to check in? Give me your call that is a name right now. I do hear a one syllable every so often. Go ahead and give your phone number, Rich. N2EO, K2RAW. Rich Entulio, who is looking for an antenna raising party for this early spring for his R8 antenna, Cushcraft, and his NFED-ZIP. His phone number is 631-855-6425. And good barbecue is being promised. The next person who signed in was Wes in 2XJN. Let's see what your ham radio question is, Wes. In 2XJN, K2LIW.
So I think about talking after Paul, but it looks like there are not many guys with us. Would that be ham radio related? Well, if I ask you the question, how the electromagnetic wave traveled through the space, and is the temperature of vacuum zero? I'm trying to see the average.
Okay, I think I understand, Wes, that after Paul, you would like to discuss those particular subjects. The next person who checked in with a real question was, I'm not sure if KC2UJL did or didn't have a question. I'm going to give him a chance. He can ask a question if he wants to. KC2UJL, K2LIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick. Okay, I think I understand, Wes, that Paul would like to... Looks like Tony... I was fairly sure Tony only checked in to let us know for his... Let us know that he was there. The next real questioner is Steve, KC2MDP. And Steve, I'll discuss anything except antennas. What would you like to talk about? I'm having fun with Steve. He does a lot of antenna experimenting. KC2MDP, K2RW, you got it, Steve.
Okay, Dick, thank you very much. And yeah, you should get the Academy Award for ham radio, Dick. I have a question. It's not ham radio related, but it is RF related. I'll throw this one basically out to the net. I don't know how knowledgeable you are on this subject, but it's on smart meters. Anything you could tell me about, you know, the electric meters, the smart meters as far as RF wise? I've heard so many conflicting stories about these things, and you know, you look on like YouTube and all these websites and everything, and these things got people quite scared, you know, with the RF that's supposedly coming out of them. And, you know, just any information you give me, you know, what's the power output, you know, what's the duration cycle of these things, stuff like that. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, a smart person knows something about what he doesn't know. Give us a few words as to what is a smart meter. I sense that it is a fairly newly introduced product of some kind. How is it advertised, Steve? What does the manufacturer claim it can do? Roughly, what does it cost? So before we get into the specifics of whether or not it represents a radio frequency biohazard, I'm pretty sure I know what the answer that's going to be if it's being manufactured and sold in the United States. It's going to have to meet some reasonably strict rules with reference to a specific absorption rate, power flux density, and so on. So we can discuss those issues, but make believe I'm hearing the word smart meter for the first time. From what you know, Steve, what does it look like? How big is it? What is it intended to do? KC2MDP, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, it's basically an electric meter. You know, you got your old single-stator meter out to measure your kilowatt hours. This is new. It's all digital, and basically it supposedly, from what I've read, and I've read so many different things, but I'll give you what the basically what the AARRL says on it. It's basically it's a digital meter, and it puts out an RF signal, and it puts out basically like an RF pulse every 15, 20 minutes, and it's on a 902 band, or it's on, I think it's on like 2.4, somewhere in that area. It says basically the meter is an average of 1 watt. I've read stories where people say these things are putting as much as 4 watts out. So basically it's an electric meter. They take the old meter out to replace this thing. It sends an RF signal. That way basically They don't have to send a guy to read the meter. Back to you, Dick.
Now I'm getting the picture. So it is the one-hour meter on the outside of your house, which is now operating wirelessly. And there's a good chance, in my opinion, it's operating on either of those 802.11-like frequencies. 915 megacycles, 902 to 928 inclusive. And I've now spent the last 10 years of my life working on handheld RFID readers or interrogators that use that exact same band, the exact same frequencies, the exact same powers, and the 1 watt versus 4 watts and so on. I'm pretty sure I can explain this to you. And in the case of handheld RFID reader, there, in many cases, it's got a directive antenna, which you you aim at the radio frequency ID tag, and it sends a signal to the tag that gets rectified. The rectified signal becomes a DC voltage on a capacitor. The capacitor becomes a temporary battery. The battery runs the integrated circuit chip, and the integrated circuit chip then spits back a 96-bit code. Lots of information. Let me drop. Now, in order to meet the FCC requirements for a license-free 902 to 928 megacycles, for instance, and that's, in my opinion, the most likely frequency region they're using, the FCC allows you to run as much as 1 watt, nothing more, if and only if you're on a pseudo-random sequence where you hop roughly 50 channels between 902 and 928 in a pseudo-random manner. So you're doing this random hop, and you're not dwelling on any one frequency for more than a few milliseconds. And the reason for that is because in the old days, there used to be cordless telephones on fixed channels somewhere between 902 and 928 megahertz. And by way of this random hopping around, the person almost doesn't know. Occasionally, he'll hear a click, but it doesn't even interrupt a symbol, a syllable of his conversation that he might be having on his cordless phone. So it's a way of sharing this frequency among a whole lot of license-free services, and everybody doesn't get interfered because of this random hopping sequence. Let me drop. Now, on this license-free band, you're not allowed to radiate more than 1 watt, but you are allowed to use an antenna that has up to, but not more than, 6.0 dB of gain over isotropic. 6 dB of gain is a 4-to-1 ratio. So 1 watt of real radiated power into a 6 dB gain antenna makes your effective radiated power 4 watts, only in the direction of the antenna that's got the 6 dB of gain. Any normal antenna with 6 dB of gain has got about an 85 or a 90 degree beam width, both in azimuth and elevation. So it's a little bit like a very broad fleshlight, if you know what I mean. And because you're continuously hopping in frequency and transmitting 1 watt real power, but 4 dB of antenna gain, your next question would be, how close would you have to be if it was a continuous transmission in order to exceed the radio frequency biohazard of the so-called C95 report? Let me drop. There is a defining document for the whole darn United States, and that includes OSHA, NIOSH, all of your armed services and whatever. They all meet the so-called C95 report of the American National Standards Institute, ANSI. So it's called the ANSI C95 report, which has got a name that goes on for a paragraph, which is really radio frequency biohazard from 0 to 300 gigahertz. And so when you read that report, you'll find out that the most dangerous frequency region is from 30 to 300 megacycles, the so-called, 30 to 300, the VHF region is the most so-called dangerous, because in that frequency region, all the RF energy that hits you gets absorbed and turned into heat. The 60 years of experience of the NCC95 report has shown that as long as you meet those requirements for maximum permitted exposure, which nowadays it's in the vicinity of 1 milliwatt per square centimeter, is 1.6 watts per kilogram of specific absorption rate. There's various ways you can read, you can figure out exactly how much signal is coming out of there. And because the most vulnerable part of a human being is the eye, and the eye has a thermal time constant of about 6 minutes. So the C95 report, all of those readings are readings where, let me drop, that as long as you need those readings are where you average the power for a 6 minute period. So you could even run, in theory, more power than that, but for a less than 6 minute period of continuous transmission. When you go through the specifics of 1 watt of real power, 6 dB of antenna gain, 915 megacycles of frequency, if it was a continuous key down transmitter, Steve, you'd have to stand approximately 2 feet or closer in front of that. Maybe it's 2.5 feet, in that vicinity. If you did a fairly simple calculation of assuming it was a isotropic radius, in other words, it's like a light bulb in a spherical room, and that the signal is 4 watts of effective radiated power in all directions at once, and your next question is how much area of room is required so that that 4 watts smeared everywhere across that sphere comes down to 1 milliwatt per square centimeter, which turns about to be, I think it's 10 watts per square meter. If you go through the mathematics of that, it's not too difficult. You'll find that it's something in the vicinity of 2.5 feet. So as long as you're more than 2.5 feet in front of the thing, and it's running key down transmission, you're right at the threshold of alarm for the current American national standard, which has been around now for 60 years. There's a similar document for the Radio Protection Board for the United Kingdom, Norway, Denmark, the United Kingdom, Australia, Japan. They've all got a very similar report, and if you compare them, they all hang together, if you know what I mean. Let me drop it. So the main thing that you care about most, Steve, is that it is a 6 minute integration period. So that even if they were violating the FCC rules somehow and transmitting, let me pick a number, a kilowatt, but doing it for milliseconds of pulses, and therefore when they average it over a 6 minute period, if it comes up lower than these standards, when averaged over 6 minutes, it is safe as far as eye protection is concerned. That's the most vulnerable part of a human being. If you did put 100 milliwatts per square centimeter, let me think what that is. That's almost a kilowatt per square meter. If you put that amount of power for more than 6 minutes continuously into a human eye, there's a reasonable probability you might develop a cataract. As you can see, the real amount of power for the real amount of time required to create damage from RF energy is a hell of a lot different than everyone thinks. Let me drop one more time. And part of all the scare is really a vocabulary scare, Steve, because it's called RF radiation. And it's that word radiation that scares people, because they make the mistake of lumping it together with nuclear radiation, which is so-called ionizing. In other words, the individual particles of a nuclear reactor, a nuclear emitter, or a microscopic bullet, so to speak, traveling at close to the speed of light. When they hit your body, they potentially do damage and can disturb your DNA and can potentially make a cancer. Radio energy is so much lower in frequency that each individual photon of RF energy is way below the characteristics by orders of magnitude. It is a non-ionizing radiation. Of all the 60 years of study of the ANSI report, which has, by the way, 1,000 references from the world's best institutions, testing laboratories, and so on, lots of data, all they've gathered has told you that the only effect of radio energy hitting a human being that they can detect is a heating effect. They've been looking for the non-thermal effects. In other words, people used to worry. Let me drop. People worried that the RF energy would get coupled into the body in such a way that your nerves would be rectifying the energy, and it would be creating phony signals to the nerves, and you'd lose muscle control and whatever. People worried about those effects. After 60 years of testing, they cannot find it. Every so often, somebody thinks they see an extremely minor non-thermal effect, and when somebody repeats it in another laboratory, it doesn't repeat. So it's really a mistake, if you know what I mean. the radio energy is a hell of a lot safer than you think. The biggest mistake that the radio scientists made around 1900 or so, when it was first coming about, is they, because the signal goes out in all directions, it radiates, and therefore the process got to be called radiation. Perfectly good word, until World War II came along, and we had nuclear radiation. If we could go back in time, we should have called it radio transmission, radio signaling, sending data. There's all kinds of other words we could have used other than radiation that's creating this, what's the word for it? This is xenophobic effect that people have. And so the worst situation I know of on Long Island is in the township of Oyster Bay in the village of Bayville. For the last 3 or 4 years, the residents of Bayville have come to the conclusion that all cell phones and similar things are dangerous, and they're trying to eliminate all cell phone antennas from their village. And they've got 3 simultaneous lawsuits trying to do that. They're wasting their time, but some very charismatic person in the village of Bayville has stirred up that community, and the majority of the people believe that. They have a website you can go to, which is extremely biased, called BRAC, BRAC, Bayville Residents Against Cell Towers, BRACT. You go to that website and you read the stuff, and you'll say, wow, boy, are these people biased. And they're sincere people, and some of my relatives live there. They really think they're protecting their children, but they're misunderstanding the physics and the philosophy of what's going on here. There probably are some further questions, but maybe that'll help someone, Steve. KC2MDP, Mr. RF, K2RIW in the TechNet.
QEO.
Steve first. Go ahead, Steve.
Hey, Dick. Yeah, thank you very much. Yes, I agree wholeheartedly, 100% on what you say, and I try and tell these people this, but basically I'm called stupid. I don't know what I'm talking about. Go to this website. Go to that website. All these supposed documented cases of people getting cancer and brain tumors and headaches and all this other stuff from RF radiation. Just a quick one, Dick. Let's say I'm one of those people that think RF radiation is the most horrible thing in the world. What would you tell them? Back to you.
I'm going to have to find this particular report that was written by the FCC, which does a beautiful job of explaining it. It used to be on the website for the village of Bayville. And during the middle of that lawsuit, the village put out some very nice information. They also hired a consulting firm to come and make measurements. And the measurements they made were almost right at the threshold of what can just barely be measured on the instrumentation as to the amount of radio energy running around Bayville. And the Bayville people are trying to remove all antennas from their town. That means cell phone, fire, police, and ambulance services. They want all of those antennas put in some other town. Now, the exact answer, unfortunately, is not a good answer. In other words, the answer that is traceable to the Bureau of Standards is the so-called ANSI, American National Standards Institute, C95 report. I mean, that is I don't know the exact number, it's probably an 80-page document with 1,000 references representing the last 60 years of research on radio frequency biohazard. It is the defining document for the United States. And that, so all of your armed services and OSHA and NIOSH all refer back to that document. That is the foundation. Let me drop. The problem is that you and I, as an engineer, can read that document and understand it with a little bit of difficulty, because the terms for radio frequency biohazard and power flux density and specific absorption rate and total radiated power, you use all of these terms. As an engineer, you and I can slowly understand them. You allow a ordinary American citizen without an engineering background to read that document, and he's going to say, this is all gobbledygook. Also, you have to be careful about the fact that there's a tremendous amount of information on the Internet. The good news is a lot of information. The bad news is not all of it is traceable to the Bureau. Some of it is complete garbage, and even though it's written with what looks like authority. Now, when it comes to the best organization I know of, which I'm a member of, the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, IEEE, they have a special division called Antennas and Propagation. Let me drop. And I could send you a report that was in the journal for the IEEE Antennas and Propagation Society, oh, about three quarters of a year or a year ago. It reports on what happened in the town of Lyon, France. Lyon, France had a cell tower that was erected right alongside of an apartment building. The people in the apartment building started developing headaches, difficulty in concentrating, diarrhea, upset stomach, forgetfulness, trouble sleeping, throat problems. The people were putting up tinfoil on the windows to try to protect themselves on the side of the apartment building that faced the cell site. The people created a great big lawsuit in the local municipality, and the judge said that there is no evidence that this cell site is creating this damage, but because there are so many people describing so much grief, for the time being, we will make a decision to order the cell site to be removed. The cell site was ordered to be removed. The company putting up the cell site said, this is crazy. We hadn't yet installed the antennas. It's only the tower. The system wasn't yet operational. All of these people had convinced each other by psychosomatic means, so to speak, that they were all suffering all of these medical problems because of that cell site that was about to be erected alongside of this an apartment building. As you can tell, there's a number of reports on the internet that you and I can find. Let me drop them. That really have questionable background. Many of those reports that you can read by going to the website called BRACT, Bayville Residents Against Cell Towers, BRACT.com or .org, I'm not sure which it is. You read the reports that they have collected. And in other words, if anybody had a snippet of information that sounds like radio energy is dangerous to human beings, it appeared on that website. And none of it is traceable to the Bureau. None of it is real laboratory measurements with real equipment. So the fact that you and I can find alarming reports doesn't mean there's a cause for alarm in this area. There's a tremendous amount of misunderstanding because of that darn word, radiation. As I said, the website of the Village of Bayville used to have a very nice report. Unfortunately, they removed everything because of these lawsuits, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to find you a copy of it, but I'm going to try. Let's see, drag your feet a little bit in case anyone else has further information on the subject. KC2MDP to take it with a delay. K2RIW, protect that.
WS2N.
Go right ahead, Paul.
I don't have a meter that's transmitting on that frequency, but I've got a thermometer outside that transmits on 33 centimeters. 915 megahertz, and I think it's every 4 seconds it transmits. So, I mean, I don't see any animals out there that look unhappy to keep hopping around the fence where I got it bolted to. Back to you, Dick.
Comment, KC2RFM. Go right ahead, Alan, and wait for the beep.
Yeah, Dick, what you're talking about is more common than you might think, and it can be found on every segment of the population. When I was in, I think I was an intern, I just finished medical school, and I was in the hospital, and we had these, you know, the beginnings, the first of the little laser lights, you know, the little laser pointers. And I was using one and showing it to some people. And remember, they're only a few milliwatts. There's no power to them whatsoever. You don't want to shine it in somebody's eyes, of course. But I had just turned it on, and I was pointing to things with it, and a little dot on the wall. And two doctors, the chief of our family practice department and the chief resident of the department, were freaking out because the chief resident was pregnant. And they said, how can you turn that on around her? How can you turn it on around her? And these are knowledgeable physicians. They are really brilliant people. And I could not believe how they descended into like cavemen, so frightened of the technology. And this is what we're dealing with, Dick, you know, because they saw what looked like a radiation symbol on the laser pointer. And these are people who are reading electrocardiograms to see how your heart is working. And I mean, if they can understand that, they should easily be able to understand the concepts behind a laser pointer. But they didn't. And they really recoiled from it. It was a real lesson in life. And I have a second one for you, Dick.
Here we go, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to give you a couple of words on laser pointers, Alan. To be legal in the United States, shipped to the American public, it cannot exceed 5 milliwatts. At 5 milliwatts, a laser pointer is essentially eye-safe. If you aimed it directly into someone's eye, you will not create damage. The amount of brilliance will be very uncomfortable to the person, and they might see a dot in their vision for some time. You're going to create a little bit of bleaching temporary of the retina. But 5 milliwatts is considered safe under normal circumstances. When it's reflecting off a wall X number of feet away, the amount of energy coming back off of there, your eye sees it as a nice, brilliant spot which has got that speckled appearance. Because it's so unusual from everything you've ever seen as a flashlight, so to speak, it alarms people. And the word laser also sounds wicked. But and when people worry about a 5 milliwatt laser aimed at an aircraft that's landing, without a doubt, it's something you shouldn't do. It's dangerous. The only thing that I really worry about is, let me drop. If you search around far enough, you can find super-powered laser pointers that run 30, 50, and as high as 100 milliwatts. Now we're getting into dangerous territory. If somebody did buy one of these non-authorized, so to speak, beyond the 5 milliwatts rating. You said you had another report along these lines, Alan? Go right ahead. KC2RFN, K2RAW in the TechNet.
N1YDY has a laser pointer comment from airplanes.
YDY recognized. We're going to go back to Alan first. Go ahead, Alan.
Okay, Hank, I'm going to hear what you say in a moment. I just want to throw this one more thing out there. Again, my point is that these are educated people, highly educated people, who should know better, and they still freak out. And I think that's what makes the Bayville incident much more believable, because to me that's terribly unbelievable in this modern day and age. It's like out of an episode of The Twilight Zone. My brother was in law school, and one of his roommates, who was a year ahead of him, what he used to do was an odd thing that my brother noticed. He would microwave something in the kitchen. As soon as he hit the button in the microwave, he would run out. But even after it announced, you know, through a bell or a buzzer that the timing was done and that microwave was finished, he would still wait a few minutes before he would walk in and get his food. And my brother finally asked him, "Why do you always wait to go in and get your food?" And he said he was waiting for the microwave radiation to disperse.
I've got a story to tell you about that one, which I'm going to hold off. We've got two people now in order, is both Rich and William. Rich, N2EO, did you want to add something to this particular subject? Go ahead, Rich, K2LAW. Rich, I'm hearing you on the input. You're asking if you're coming through, and the answer is no. Nothing you're saying at this time is coming through, Rich. Go ahead.
Can I make my statement?
Okay. You said, "What's the problem?" Then I'll make you my statement. I didn't understand that, Rich. Go ahead.
Okay, Dick. What? Here we go.
Yeah, nothing about what you said came through the repeater, Rich, but Rich is reporting on a report he's read, and quite a few of us have read this, a kind of radio diathermy. In other words, by directing radio energy with or without chemotherapy at the same time, there are ways that have been studied of irradiating a particular tumor and heating the tumor, hopefully with great accuracy, and not heating the surrounding materials. And because of the thermal sensitivity of a cancerous tumor, it does give you some curative effects. And radiodiathermy is what I'm going to call it. And it's been reported quite a few times Some of that work is still going on, even though you're not hearing about it very much now. Rich is worried why we're not hearing about it. It's not easy to implement, and it's a partial success. It's not one of these things with extremely high success where everyone jumps on that bandwagon. It's an area requiring some further research. N1YDY, I think your name is Bill. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Bill. N1YDY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I can fill in the gaps on that one. For a second, hear the tone, I forgot.
Yeah, we're going to go to Eric after Bill. Bill, you've got it, and listen for the tone, you're right.
First, the name is Hank, and second, I used to fly for a living, and the whole thing with the lasers in the cockpit is that the guys that have been doing it do have those higher-powered lasers, and some of the stuff you see on the professional pilot websites, the ones that, you know, you have to be the union member and have your proper ID and password to get into, discuss these problems and where these guys get these lasers and how powerful they actually are. And the other problem is that the laminate windshield that the light has to travel through, even though the laser starts off as a coherent light, one of the things it does is it goes through the multi-pane window. I call it a window, but the windshield of an aircraft is usually a mix. If it's an old aircraft, it's got two or three different tensile strengths of glass, tempered type glass. They call it fully tempered and quarter tempered and blah, 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 but it's basically the trade-off between ductility and strength. The stronger you make something, the more fragile it is. The more modern airplanes, this tends to be a polycarbonate sandwich, but the problem is in the more modern airplanes with their compound curves and the polycarbonate sandwiches, the light is refracted in such a way in the actual windshield itself that a lot of times you can't see out of the aircraft during that time frame. That's it, and one whitey white.
Yeah, I think I see what you're saying. The scattering of the individual particles, so to speak, of the windshield when hit with a high-power laser energy from one of these high-power lasers from the ground gives you a kind of fog. And now to see through that windshield, to see the airfield where you're landing at night, that fog is the problem, the backscatter or the forward scatter of this polycarbonate windshield. Am I getting that correct, Hank? By the way, you're listed in the roster as your name being William. So you're going to have to tell the people who make up the Limog roster to correct your name, Hank. N1YDY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Snow, let it snow.
Yes, you've got the issue down pat. The windshield itself becomes effectively fogged over in a way during the time that it's illuminated with one of the...
Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Okay, Hank, I think we understand that one. And so, Hank, one further question for you. Of the reports you're able to read, I know that in many of those situations when a pilot does report that he's being irradiated from the ground and he tries to give the best address as to where it's coming from, and hopefully law enforcement is sent in those directions to try to find the perpetrator. On the reports that you've read, have they had some success of finding the perpetrator and stopping him? And when YDY, K2RIW, go ahead, Hank.
Oh, you know, I'm sure that it's limited. There's a lot more guys out there doing this than get caught. But there were two guys in Queens who were arrested in possession of these things and tried. And, you know, they didn't actually see the guy use it. You know, they knew the rough address of the building that it was coming from. And normally we use the phrase painted. So you get painted from the ground by the laser. And so anyway, we can tell the rough area that you're being painted from. So there's two guys in Queens and one guy in Chicago that I'm aware of. I don't know of anybody on the West Coast that's been apprehended for this. And one YDY.
And of those two that were apprehended, do you know what happened, Hank? Go ahead.
I really don't know. I didn't follow it up all that much. You know, it was just kind of like one of these Kiplinger letter things. I'm sure you've seen that type of format. You just read through it at the time that it occurs. And usually, you know, when you read it, it's after they've arrested the guy, but before he's gone to trial. So I really have no clue as to the final disposition of these guys. And one whitey white.
I thank you, Hank. Eric, I know you got some further information for us. KE2EJ, KE2RIW, the Tech Mask.
KE2RIW, KE2EJ. Oh, going back to what you mentioned before, with the cancer, there was a ham, I can't think of it called, he's passed on now, had the cancerous tumor. He developed a DNA binding material, which had, think of it as metal filings. It was an iron, a magnetic based material. The idea was that this would only stick to the cancer cell, and what would happen was they would expose that to a couple of kilowatts at 2 meters, in fact, it was me picked, and the idea is that those particular cells would get hot and they would get hurt, and that's where that came from. I think it was in QST, it was on TV, it was around, so it was a big story of the day. It was an interesting idea. But the guy eventually passed away. And let me drop for a second. And as far as lasers and glass, just remember that any kind of safety glass sandwich is a silica-based glass. Then essentially an optical glue, an optical gel actually, that is the glass. At the point where the two different materials meet, there's a refractive index, and the gel itself does, it's as though it's if you lit it from the side where you get the fog looking on, because it's starting up all those molecules in the glass itself, or rather within the gel material. So, by the way, that's how safety glass works. The glass breaks, but because you have this cushion layer of gel that's glued to the glass, pulls the glass in place. K2RIW,
K2EJ. Hi, thank you, Eric. Good information. On the input, I heard someone say, I have a further comment that didn't come to the machine. Now, who was that?
Roger, Dick. This is Kilo 1, Mike Juliet. Mike, am I coming through on the input?
You're coming through beautiful now.
Okay, Roger. Just wanted to make a comment. You can readily buy lasers off the internet, laser pointers, that are over, up to and over 1 watt with no problem.
From your aircraft experience, Hank, how in the world is that legal? The 100 milliwatt region is getting pretty dangerous, way beyond eye safe. By the 1 watt region, you can aim that at things and burn holes in them. I'm amazed that that's legal and not being restricted. I mean, if you and I, Hank, were advertising that we've got a 1,000-watt transmitter that we're using for the 27-megacycle citizens band, and we started advertising those, selling them, I know that the Friendly Candy Company would visit you and me real soon and stop us from doing it. What in the world is going on with these lasers? Because the general public owning one of those, there's a medium chance, in my mind, they can get themselves into a fair amount of trouble. N1YDY for a comment. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, I own a carbon dioxide and an argon laser.
I'll get you a second. Go ahead, Hank.
Okay, well, I'm not MJM, who was the guy who was making the comment, but N1YDY here, and all I can tell you is that I'm aware of people who have legally used these for transits, for sighting, geographical sighting, and property boundary markers for large distances. So if you've got somebody who's got trying to figure out the property line on something a couple of miles in length, they use things like this. N1YDY.
Hi, thank you, Hank. Eric, now your carbon arc or whatever, I think it was a carbon dioxide laser. Yes, they can run some really potent power. But not many people find a way to buy and use those. They tend to be pretty pricey. Maybe I'm wrong. And you being a guy that really knows how to get a hold of surplus equipment, probably found a way of getting one at a more convenient price. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
N1YDY does have another comment with Eric's son.
Okay, you want Mike. Now I understand. I've confused you. I'm sorry. Eric first, and then we'll go to Mike. You got it, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ.
Okay. Well, when I was a lot younger, we used to go on laser shows. We use multiple different kinds of lasers, sometimes even a xenon source, which is white, and you can use some dichroics and split off the beam to make different colors. But, I used to work on, in the old days, a laser disc recorder. If you remember the old landlord with it, that had a 1-watt argon laser in it. And a lot of times, you know, you had to tune the laser up, and sometimes you would forget. You can't be careful with that thing, because that sucker was 2 watts. The beam would shoot straight up and burn big holes in the ceiling. But, you know, the one thing that we forget about, anything that approaches a 1-watt level, you're not going to operate that on a little battery. Even the solid-state lasers now, we're getting up into the 1 and 2-watt zone. It can blow a lot of current. You know, it's not the most efficient thing in the world, so I wouldn't really worry about somebody coming outside with a 1-watt laser pointing it up, because you need a good hefty power supply for that. Although they're getting more efficient, but we're not quite there yet. And the carbon dioxide laser, that thing needs about 30 amps to make that go, and that's only a 5-watt laser. I can crank it up to 10 watts. And then I have my little homemade one that I made years ago. And that sucker draws a lot of current, too. So you need a decent power supply. So, you know, I wouldn't worry about, 1 watt or greater being out there. But, you know, 500 milliwatts, half a watt, it's getting there. Battery don't last long. But the solid-state lasers are beginning to get into those ranges. Get your RWK to the judge.
Another comment?
No, we got 2 more comments coming up. Eric, when you guys were doing that work, were you and your staff using eye protection?
No, it was mandatory. I mean, this is before the days of OSHA even, but yeah, so we were pretty much real stick in the mud about that. Because when you finally do a public show, you want the actual amount of energy that's coming out of the devices to be well in the, 1, 2, 3 milliwatt range, but a lot of the devices with the mirrors and the attenuators and stuff that you have on it, because you are moving that beam around, the actual amount of energy that's coming out of it, and if it's too hot, you actually tune it down so it's not.
Understand, Eric. Okay, N1MJM, I think it was, mic number 2. Go right ahead, Mike.
Had a comment also.
Energy that's coming out of the device to be no long range, but
N1MJM, are you there, Mike?
It's too hot, you actually.
Laser pointer. They're about 1 1/8 inch in diameter and about 8 inches long, and they hold the charge. Probably for 5 to 7 minutes.
Yeah, that sounds very good. Please repeat that whole message, Mike.
Now, know about lasers. They're about 1 1/8 inch in diameter. They're
N1MJM, are you there, Mike?
8 inches long, and they hold a charge. You can use them for about 5 to 7 minutes.
What's the approximate price of those? And where have you seen them advertised? Okay, go ahead, Mike.
Roger, if you just Google 1,000 milliwatt laser pointers, you'll find them. They import them from China. They're about $200, $225, somewhere in that ballpark.
Amazing. And Hank, I think you said you had a further word. N1YDY, D2RIW, and the tech man.
N1YDY, D2RIW, Dick, I wanted to tell you that I also remember seeing in the latest,
Where have you seen them advertised? Okay, go ahead, Mike. Hank, would you be willing to repeat that message one more time? K2L.
Mike.
One, K2LIW, the segment.
N1YDY, D2RIW, Dick, I wanted to tell you that I also remember some kind of small head that you could aim for the purpose of getting the attention of searching for you, and it had essentially a mirror with a sight gauge that you could use. So I'm not, I don't know the output. I do know that it's a green laser, but I don't know the technical output for the thing.
Thank you, Hank. Look what you started, Steve. But radiation is an interesting subject. Let's see, there was something I was going to add. I forget what the subject was just before that. Medical lasers? No, we covered that one.
Diathermy?
We had sort of covered this. Alan? There was another point I was going to make a comment on, but will come to me later. Okay, Steve, you've asked a very interesting question, and please bring it up again, because we amateurs have a responsibility here. Let me drop. Started, Steve. The radiation is and that is that we are the so-called radio experts, from my point of view. You and I, as ham radio operators, we use radio and we breathe and live with it and so on. So we have a responsibility to slowly convince the American public that it is safe and that you have to do some pretty dumb things to really get yourself in trouble. In the case of a cell phone, for instance, it's kind of hard to believe that the cell phone against your head is giving you an amount of radio energy into your body that is more than a million times greater than if you lived directly next door to a cell site base station and you made the measurement during the rush hour when the cell site is running hot and heavy, if you know what I mean. Because of the inverse square law, the distance, you can't be any closer than about 200 feet, and you're below the pancake antenna pattern. You put it all together, there's more than a million times more energy going into your body from that cell phone against your head. Whereas the American public, let me drop. The American public, looking at that half $1 million worth of hardware, 150 feet high, 50,000 pounds of stuff, they're looking at that cell site, and to them it's massive. It's obviously got to be more dangerous than this tiny little cell phone that weighs a few ounces that's against my head. You stand in front of a zoning board and say those words, and they'll basically say you're crazy. What the hell planet are you coming from? And yet, what you're speaking is traceable to the Bureau, if you know what I mean. So, what is and is not dangerous when it comes to radio biohazard is sometimes very different than common sense. But that word radiation, we got to somehow negate that word, if you know what I mean. You try to explain to the American public that there's a huge difference between ionizing and non-ionizing radiation, and their eyes just glaze over. Okay, we're going to go on to our next person, Joe. And Joe, let's see if you can clear all this up. I'm having some fun with Joe. W2BMP, KTN, K2RW. You got it, Joe. The Bureau, if you know what I mean. So, what is...
I was adding a counterpoise to an HT. So, the question I was asked by one of my students is, if I add a wire counterpoise to my Baofeng radio, will my performance improve? And if so, how long does the counterpoise have to be on 2 meters?
Comment.
Okay, I heard somebody say comment. We'll get to you in a minute. In the case of a 2 meter handy-talkie that's in your hand, if you use the right kind of instrumentation, the equivalent of an infrared camera, so to speak, and you see where the radio wave is coming from, what is the counterpoise? It turns out that rubber duck antenna is using as a counterpoise the rest of the metallic package that's inside of the plastic package. The rest of the metallic package is part of the counterpoise, as well as the hand and the arm of the person holding onto it. You could add a whole bunch of wires to the base of that thing, trying to make a more defined counterpoise if you wanted to. Let me drop. The first thing that would happen is you would be changing the impedance of the antenna. So the manufacturer did a certain good job of impedance matching the final stage of the transmitter to that rubber duck under normal working conditions, and you'd be disturbing that. My gut feel, though, is that if you put the world's most perfect ground plane under your Baofeng, you'd make a 1.5 dB of improvement. It's not going to be night and day. Of the energy that's radiated by that final stage of your transmitter into that rubber duck, everybody thinks a rubber duck antenna is very inefficient. It doesn't have real high gain like a Yagi, but It's a quasi-omnidirectional radiator. In other words, it's almost like a light bulb in a spherical room, so to speak. But of the 3 watts or 5 watts coming out of that final stage, 4 and a fraction watts of that is being radiated into space. You got to be careful when you make that statement.